This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm quite looking forward to today's conversation, to be honest, because the book is titled Electric Dreams, Sex Robots and Failed Promises of Capitalism, published by 404 Inc. And this is a really interesting book because it takes this kind of question that maybe doesn't dominate the internet, but certainly doesn't seem like it's a question that's going away anytime soon. The idea of in the future, everyone or some people or some undistinguished kind of people will be having sex with robots. That seems like something worth interrogating a little bit, I think. And thankfully, we have the author of the book who's done exactly that with us. We have Heather Perry here to discuss all things Electric Dreams, really. So Heather, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Miranda. Thank you so much for having me. I can't wait to chat.
Likewise. Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and tell us kind of how and why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a writer of fiction and nonfiction based in Glasgow here in Scotland, though I'm originally from Yorkshire. And I've been trying to write this book in one way or another for about 6 years, I think, maybe even longer now. I came to this issue from a philosophy background. I'm a philosophy graduate, and I have always been really interested in the kind of promises of AI. So I studied quite a lot about theory of mind and consciousness and these kind of things. So when the AI kind of conversation really started happening, I started to be really kind of cynical about the promises that were being made. And the kind of problem of mind, you know, the kind of great philosophical problem of mind seemed to me to really stand in the way of this future that we were being told is kind of just on the horizon. And from there, I got more into robotics. I started reading all the kind of very popular AI robotics books that were coming out from people whose names you will know, who I won't name just for being professional. And then I read a book. I'm not going to be professional here. I will absolutely name the book and the writer. I read a book called Love and Sex with Robots by David Levy. And I wish I could show you my copy because it has about 250 angry post-it notes in it, I think. I remember reading it on a plane and just kind of scrolling in the margins. I must have looked slightly unhinged. But this book was just sort of everything that I think is wrong with the conversation about robotics and about the future of robots and about how humans will interact with robots and how we interact with technology now. And the main claim in the book is that by 2050, which is really not so far away now, we will be marrying and having sex with humanoid robots, specifically humanoid robots that are indistinguishable from human people. That's David Levy's phrasing. And that this will be as normal as marrying and having a relationship and having sex with another person. And you would think that that's quite a bold claim, and you would think that that would be picked apart by the kind of critical media. But it really wasn't. It had great reviews in things like the Washington Post. And I became very kind of annoyed by this. And that the questions that I wanted to ask of it weren't being asked. So that led me into this sometimes dark world of sex robots. And it took me to some very dark places and the internet. And finally resulted in Electric Dreams.
Hmm. Thank you for taking us through the kind of evolution of the project. I can, you know, that image of you on a plane frantically scribbling is very evocative. So a lovely place to start. To ground the rest of our conversation, though, I want to make sure that everyone's clear about kind of what exactly we're talking about here. So when you say sex robots, what kind of sex robots are we examining in the book?
Well, the main claim in Love and Sex with Robots is about a robot that does not currently exist. So I think that's an important thing to have in our minds as we have this conversation. They are humanoid robots, bipedal robots, that look like people and talk like people and have consciousnesses that can be said to be analogous to people. The word indistinguishable always sticks in my head because it really takes you to a kind of Blade Runner place. So these are the robots that we're apparently going to have by 2050. The sex robots that we need to talk about, however, are the ones that we have, which aren't really sex robots at all. So when you read about sex robots in the media, or when people talk about them generally, they're usually talking about one specific robot. And again, I don't even really like using the term robot here because it's not correct, but I'll explain why. They're usually talking about Harmony, which is a silicon sex doll with a robotic, or you might say animatronic head, from a company called Abyss Creations, who I think are in California. And if you've ever read any of the very kind of hypey media articles about sex robots, and you've seen one of them speak, and I say one of them in huge inverted commas, you're probably thinking of Harmony. So, you know, they're very kind of perfectly realized silicon artworks, if you will. I mean, they look fantastic from a kind of engineering perspective. You know, they look very, very human, as much as silicon dolls can be. And then the robotic head that we're told is what makes them kind of so desirable. Well, in the media, you have all these journalists saying, oh, it's really actually quite incredible. And, you know, the degrees of movement are amazing. But when you actually watch the videos of Harmony moving and speaking, it's really quite uncanny. And it's, for me, it's quite amazing because they look awful. They don't look realistic. You know, she doesn't have a personality. She has an AI, and I say AI in inverted commas as well, because it's basically just a preloaded kind of personality. And really weirdly, she has a Glasgow University accent most of the time, which living and working in Glasgow, I find quite interesting. But they are the ones that currently exist. So Harmony is the kind of the most realized version of the idea. And even then, she's very, very far away from what we're promised.
Huh. Okay, lots of very helpful points to keep in mind there. So thank you for giving us that grounding in the subject of the rest of the conversation. Something I'd like to pull out a bit more that we've sort of implicitly included is the idea that conversations about sex robots are not just about sex robots, right? They're about kind of what the future could look like or should look like. They're about the world we're in now, about technology and the tech industry. Why do you think that conversations about sex robots are that sort of lens to have these bigger conversations?
That's a great question. I think it's because it says a lot about us as humans and the way we interact with each other. But it also says a lot about the tech industry. I think the idea of sex robots and the kind of hype around them and the way we seem to be so enamored with the idea, even though it is so far away from what we've actually got. I think that is a very interesting lens on kind of what we believe about technology and what we believe about the future and how capitalism is currently working. So in the book, I kind of take the concept of sex robots from five different angles. One of them is as a trigger for what I think is quite a regressive feminism. One is as a kind of product of a colonialist masculinity. One is a kind of totem of hyper-individualism. And I think if you kind of pull back from the very obvious questions about sex robots, which a lot of books and a lot of media seem to engage with. You know, what would they look like and what are their questions of consent and, you know, who are they made towards and who do they exclude and all these kind of things. If you step back from that, I think it's actually a much more interesting question of why do we believe this idea? Why do we want to believe this idea? What do they actually offer us as people? And I think it's important to say, I'm not kind of coming at this from a sex negative angle or even from an angle of really wanting to shame people who find this an attractive idea. I think if you are into the idea of having a robot that you have sex with, I think that's actually fine broadly. I think, you know, we have all kinds of desires and we have all kinds of kinks, and that kind of human expression and human, what's the word? Human interest, I don't think should be shamed, really. What I'm trying to look at sex robots from is a critical lens on why they have become such a seductive idea and what kind of gap they seem to be filling, if you pardon the phrasing, what gap they seem to be filling in people's lives.
That's a very useful way, I think, of helping us expand the conversation, and leads me sort of nicely to talk about that gap that they might conceptually, theoretically be filling. Kind of who are sex robots made for, and what does this tell us about these questions of where we're at as a society?
I really appreciate the fact that we're really trying to avoid innuendo, but it's almost impossible in this conversation, so apologies to the listeners for that. So if you look at the sex robots that we kind of currently have, and again, I use that term under duress, but I will. If you look at the sex robots we have and the way that they are rendered in books like Love and Sex with Robots, they are very much made towards a straight male gaze. So think of the kind of most stereotypically realized attractive woman that you can think of. That's what they are made to look like. So they seem to have enormous breasts, and they seem to have huge asses and tiny waists, and they are for the most part white as well. You do have some racialized sex robots, and by that I of course mean the sex dolls, but they tend to be fetishized. The language that's used around them tends to be very fetishized and sometimes just straight out racist. They seem to be, I kind of use the phrase in the book, it seems to be a kind of stunted heterosexuality they're aiming towards. You know, the kind of male, the kind of heterosexual masculinity that will type big boobies into Google when someone's 15. They seem to really be aiming towards that kind of desire, which is actually not the desire that I think straight men have. At least I want to believe they don't have that. So they seem to be aiming for a particular idea of masculinity. And it is masculinity as well, and it is straight masculinity. From what we know from all the research, gay men don't really seem to be interested in sex robots. Gay women don't really seem to be interested in the idea of sex robots. So it really is that kind of straight white male, if we say that that's kind of reflective in the design. And I guess they're aimed at a kind of lonely audience as well. I think what comes up in this conversation is the idea that what kind of person really want from a sex robot outside of sex. And in books like David Levy's book, what you get is this idea that some men are actually afraid of human women, or they're not finding what they need from human interaction. And the idea that's being sold to them is not just a sexual one, it's a kind of pseudo relationship one as well. So I have found myself in some truly awful corners of the internet in the last few years researching this book. So I've been on a lot of incel forums and a lot of forums populated by people who call themselves men going their own way, which is quite a clunky phrase, but it's kind of an incel-adjacent group of men. And these people really seem to like the idea of sex robots because it removes them from the world of straight women. And what you find is that they have been hurt by women, and they find the kind of dating game quite an alienating one. Obviously, the kind of incel worldview is that there are some people who've won the genetic lottery in life, and if you aren't one of these people who looks a very particular way, you will not be able to find satisfying sex. You won't be able to find a satisfying relationship, which I think is a very pregnant and awful idea, really. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for men who've been marginalized in that way or pushed into corners. Not to say that I don't have criticisms of how that worldview is, I really do, but I think it speaks to a loneliness and a lack of confidence in interacting with other humans. And of course, what a sex robot promises you is not just this kind of tantalizing sexual experience. It promises you someone who can satisfy you without all the messy kind of complications of other human people. And I think this is really telling because it speaks to a kind of commodification of human interaction, and it speaks to a kind of falling apart of human connection, I think. And very cynically, the idea of sex robots exploits this and also furthers it, because what it's really telling these men is that you don't actually have to change yourself. You don't have to interrogate how you think about women and how that might be affecting your relationships or your relationship prospects. It just kind of says, well, you can just buy a sex robot and then you can just check out of the difficult and challenging and awful human interaction that's, you know, hurt you or pushed you in this direction.
Can we poke at that a little bit? The idea of kind of being pushed into corners or the horrible situations that they're in. Those don't come out of necessarily nowhere, right? There's a lot of factors that create these sorts of situations. To what extent is neoliberalism one of them?
That's a very good question. I think there are a few different things that play into this. I think social media, we often talk about how it affects women's kind of self-regard, but I think we don't talk about how it affects men's self-regard. So I think that's one huge point there. But yeah, neoliberalism generally has played into what I think of as the kind of cult of the tech entrepreneur. And I think sex robots have come out of that kind of cultish idea. So neoliberalism has really kind of, you know, as a market-driven belief in one person who's going to achieve our dreams, you know, one person who's going to take our future ideas and make them real, if we think of it that way. That has played into this idea that technology companies and the people behind them are leaders, which I think is a very interesting and, what am I trying to say here? It's an idea that gets away from the problems of life, really. So if we take, I hate to evoke him, but if we take Elon Musk as a kind of example of this, Elon Musk gets a huge amount of money from the US government. He gets US government subsidies that kind of keep his companies afloat. And because of that, we have to kind of create this cult of personality around Elon Musk to justify giving him all this public money. So we think, oh, he's going to change the face of America. He's going to change the face of the planet. He's going to create these things that solve our problems. It's kind of capitalism, you know, taken to its nth degree. So we have media that creates this kind of cult of personality around those people who are just insanely rich, and they are made rich often by a lot of public money. People like Jeff Bezos, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, we kind of take what they say as truth, even when there is very little to actually back up what they say. So I think that manifests in the world of sex robots, in that we take the things that are being said by people like David Levy and people like Matt McCullen, who's the head of Abyss Creations, what they say about what they can do, we believe it. So when David Levy says by 2050 we'll have humanoid robots, for some reason we believe that. I'm yet to really understand why that is, because when you actually talk to roboticists and you talk to experts, all of them say we actually can't do this. You know, there's a quote in the book from an Edinburgh-based professor called Ruth Ayler. And she says something like, as soon as you start dealing with robotics, you realize how incredible humans are, or, you know, just natural life generally is. It's phenomenal what we can do, what animals can do, what, you know, any kind of living entity can do. And that it's actually incredibly difficult to ape that from a robotics perspective. So these people are saying that. These people who actually work in the field are telling us how difficult these things will be to achieve. And yet the media is telling us the complete opposite of that. The media is saying, oh, well, look at this incredibly rich man, and they're predominantly white men, predominantly based in places like America. Look at what they're saying. This is the future. This is the truth. And Ray Kurzweil is one of these as well, where we take what they say and what they write as not a science fiction, which it is, but as a science fact and a science future. And I think the conversation in the media around sex robot plays into this as well. And I wish we had a more critical response to it. And I mean, by we, I mean the media, really.
Why don't we? Why do we take these things as fact when actually they're, as you talk about in the book, there's plenty of experts who have gone on the record and been like, actually, guys.
Well, I think it's because we like a fiction. You know, the world is an incredibly difficult place right now. We don't listen to facts from scientists that upset us and scare us because we feel very powerless. But we also kind of don't want to think about these futures that might be very challenging and might require us to make great systemic change. We like fictions that kind of bolster where we are and give excuses to the path we're currently on. You know, no one likes change. Change is hard and it's difficult, and no one likes the idea of sacrifice. You know, the idea that we will have to give up the way we live and the things we have to improve society is never a popular one, even though we might believe in the systems that we would be working towards. So it's actually a lot easier when someone says to you, well, you know, in 26 years, you'll be able to buy a person, and that person won't be difficult, and they won't have any mind of their own, and they won't push against you, and they won't, you know, bring you into the kind of messy human world. That's, I think for a lot of people, those kind of fictions are just easier. And also, science fiction's fun. I mean, you know, there's a reason that we watch Star Trek. There's a reason that we buy into these ideas. There's a reason that we read Ray Bradbury books. It's a lot of science fiction is kind of pointing towards a simpler future. And some of it is very kind of egalitarian, and some of it is very much not. But we want to believe that the future and that technology of the future has something that will make our lives easier, whereas the actual reality that we live in is that it's looking to be much, much harder than we have now, and we're going to have to start doing something about it.
I'd like to ask a bit more about the people who are making critiques of sex robots, not just the kind of people who aren't being as critical as we'd want them to be. There are some voices out there, not just your book, saying that, hang on a second, there are some reasons to not have sex robots. But some of these arguments themselves have some issues within them. Can you walk us through what those are and maybe how to avoid them?
Yeah, absolutely. So the kind of the group that's most vocally critical of the idea of sex robots is called the Campaign Against Sex Robots. And from the kind of face of it, you would think what they're saying is not challenging at all. You know, they oppose sex robots as they kind of exist now and as they are promised. So as these highly sexualized, highly fetishized, regressive kind of ideas of women, and, you know, they don't like the idea of kind of replacement of human women with sex robots. And I think that's allowing the argument on the plate, on the landscape that the creators of sex robots have created. So I think we can do better with just engaging with their argument as if it's true. But what, you know, the real problem is the Campaign Against Sex Robots relies on a comparison to sex workers. So it relies on the idea that any interaction we have with sex robots, or I should say any interaction that men have with female sex robots and female sex dolls, would be analogous to the relationship of a sex worker and a client. And it speaks about sex work in a way that sex workers that I have read would reject. So it's kind of, it makes an argument which diminishes the experiences of sex workers and the struggles of sex workers. It also kind of relies on a biological essentialism that requires a kind of ever narrowing set of criteria for womanhood, which I think excludes more women than it includes. So it kind of rejects technology and how we interact with technology as human women, you know, as we all do. And it pushes for this idea of some kind of perfect kind of physical womanhood, which you actually see a lot in on kind of Instagram, you know, this idea of the sort of divine uterus I see now and again. It always makes me think, why can't we talk about the divine pancreas? You know, all of the things in our body are incredible. They're doing incredible things, but they're leaning on what I think is quite a regressive feminist idea. And I think it also plays in the same waters as the trad wife stuff that's happening on social media, that kind of takes feminism back to the 60s or the 50s, or, you know, second or first wave feminism, or even before the feminist idea. You know, the trad wife movement is kind of based on the idea that women actually had it better when they were all trapped at home, which is very ahistorical, I would say. But it does kind of, it narrows the criteria for what a kind of physical human woman is in a way that rejects many human women, I would say. It also kind of rejects the potential neutral effects of sex robots. So what I mean by that is it's quite sex negative. It seeks to kind of shame a human desire, which I don't think is really helpful. I mean, I think a lot of us have had sexual experiences just for novelty, and I feel like a lot of the interest in sex robots is just novelty, and I think the interest would drop off very quickly if you were to actually interact with them. But essentially, there's kind of no need for these arguments, because the sex robots fail on their own terms, if you know what I mean. Like, they can't satisfy the desire that they have told us exists. So for me, it seems quite regressive to engage with them on terms that they're creating. And I mean creators of sex robots. There's kind of no need to exclude human women from this argument for the sake of narrowing the criteria. And there's no need to kind of reject technology as a potential good as well. And I think the campaign against sex robots does all of that.
Aside from avoiding those, I think, relatively reasonable requests, what else do you hope readers take away from this book and maybe do or think as a result of reading it?
I hope that they take away the idea that we can just do better than this. You know, I quote a roboticist in the book who says, you know, we could actually create much, much better sexual experiences for people using technology than a sex robot. If you think about it, it's actually really boring to think that we have all this incredible technology at our fingers, and what we're going to create is just something that looks like a person. I mean, people exist, you know. We surely can be using it to give us experiences that we can't have. And there are some very cool things being done with sex technology. I talk about the field of teledildonics in the book, which is one of my favorite words. It's just like really, really interesting, you know, giving people shared sexual experiences over distance. I think that's very, very fascinating and potentially great for people in long distance relationships, or people who've got physical disabilities, or, you know, just away from their physical partners. I think that's really exciting. I think I want people to be critical about the things that they're being told, and I want them to take this vision of the world and put it next to their vision of the world and their experience of the world, and pull it apart for that, with that in mind. And, you know, to think about what they're being told that they want as well. I think the reason that I've been so interested in this idea is that we're letting the market tell us what we're interested in. So we're letting a handful of people who are essentially in this to make, hopefully, you know, they would hope, an insane amount of money. We're letting them tell us what our sexual experience is and what our sexual desire is and what we want from sex tech. And I think that's actually really lacking. And I don't like people to speak for me. You know, I don't think I'm alone in rejecting the idea. I want to be able to say what I want, and I want to be able to voice my experience, my desire. And I think men, if they thought about it, the men who these robots are kind of marketed towards, I think if they thought it for a minute, they would actually feel very patronized. You know, I think they would feel that what they're being told they want cannot actually satisfy them. And yeah, I would like people to just think about why people are trying to sell them this idea, really, and also think about what they would like from sexual technology.
Yeah, no, so not just accept what they're being told, but also go, hang on a second, if I do think about this, what do I want? And maybe how can we move towards that instead?
Yes.
Given that we're now in the kind of big picture time period, I suppose, of the interview, I wonder if I can ask you to take us behind the scenes a little bit. We've talked about your ideas. I'm curious a bit about the process of putting this together. Was there something that you came across in the research or the writing of this book that really surprised you, even if it was something that didn't make it into the final version?
That's a great question. Well, one thing that surprised me very early on was that I was in the pub in Edinburgh, where I used to live with some friends, and I must have bored everybody I know with this topic for close to 7 years. So I was just talking with this about some friends, and it turned out my friend, who I just knew as an academic, is actually like what he called a robot psychologist. So that was, on a very literal level, that was a big surprise to me. And it opened a lot of doors into the research in this book. But in terms of something that I came across in the research, I think it's how sexual women are. You know, I knew this from a personal experience, talking to friends, all this kind of stuff. But the research actually backs up the idea that it's women who have voracious sexual appetites and who are broadly turned on by everything. You know, I read some incredible studies and some incredible books on female sexuality as the one that's kind of more enduring, more broad in its interests, more adaptable, changes over a woman's life. And I think that, as a kind of lack in the conversation around sex robots, is very obvious. No one's really talking about female sexuality. They're not even talking about women at all as potential consumers of sex robots or sex tech generally, where it is women who buy sex toys actually more than men. And what's fascinating to me is that despite that, and despite this, you know, very strong sexuality and a very strong interest in sexual toys, women just don't seem to have an interest in sex robots whatsoever. And I think that's because it's not really promising anything interesting or tantalizing or stimulating. What it is promising is an ownership. And that is, of course, then tied to a lot of horrible, regressive past ideas around male and female interactions.
That is a very interesting finding and surprise. So thank you for sharing that with us. I do just have one final question, really. We've talked about a lot of ideas. We've talked a bit about your process. Now that this book is out and available in the world, is there anything you might be working on now, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic, that you'd like to preview?
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually working on my second novel right now, which is very, very different to Electric Dreams and has almost no crossover. And also I have a Substack on which I kind of tend to talk about more things more like sex robots and, you know, the politics and technology and kind of society. And that's called General Observations on Eggs. And yeah, I people keep asking me if I'm going to write something else about sex robots, but I think I'm done with it. I can't possibly have any more ideas on this topic. And people keep asking me if I'm going to write fiction about them, but I think all the sex robot fictions are actually quite samey. You know, this idea of, we've got some great movies like Ex Machina about this kind of thing, and, you know, making human women and what we will do with them and how we interact with them and how we interact with AI and stuff like that. And I don't know what I can give to that body of work really that's interesting and new. So I'm going to stay away from it.
Fair enough. Well, you've already contributed to it with this book that we've been discussing, again, titled Electric Dreams, Sex Robots and Failed Promises of Capitalism, published by 404 Inc. Heather, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for a lovely chat, Miranda.